This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's our annual 10 Best Show, and our rock critic Ken Tucker is here with his picks for the best pop records of the year. Ken is also critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Ken, did you have a favorite record of the year?
I did. It was this collaboration between Billy Bragg and the rock band Wilco, who took a series of songs from Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie's daughter brought Billy Bragg, the English folk singer, a collection of lyrics that had never been set to music by her father. And they came up with this album called Mermaid Avenue, which is named after the street that he lived on in Coney Island. I think we all think of Woody Guthrie as, you know, the Dust Bowl poet, you know, out there in the middle of the country. But he actually led the latter half of his life in New York City. And I thought that the collection was just really terrific.
Did you feel like you learned something new about Woody Guthrie or Billy Bragg listening to it?
I did. You know, I'm not a huge Billy Bragg fan, and I thought that it brought out the best in him. And I felt that Woody Guthrie, I felt this new kind of cosmopolitan air to his work, a kind of worldliness that I hadn't really absorbed before. He has a song about his crush on Ingrid Bergman, just the kind of stuff that you think about with Woody Guthrie. You think of This Land Is Your Land and stuff like that, and it peeled off the layers of cliche that have accreted around Woody Guthrie, I thought.
You want to play a track from it?
Yes, a really nice little number called Walt Whitman's Niece.
Let's hear it. That's Billy Bragg's recording of Woody Guthrie songs, Ken Tucker's favorite record of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that song is rowdier than I've heard Billy Bragg, Wilco, or Woody Guthrie ever be. I think that it brought out the best in all three of those performers.
Well, the album that you chose as record of the year, the Billy Bragg record, is not one of those like big industry gazillion selling type records.
No.
What was happening in that stratosphere of the music industry this year?
Well, it was the industry had no center this year. I've been reading very carefully my colleagues in lists of year-end summations, wondering if I'm missing that there was some secret center of the recording industry that around which everything gathered, and there isn't. I mean, to me, the moment that crystallizes the year was in late November, the so-called Super Tuesday phenomenon, in which a bunch of record labels released major releases by Garth Brooks, Whitney Houston, Jewel, Mariah Carey, Seal, all on the same day. And it was the idea was just to see, you know, how many records everybody could sell at the start of this holiday season. And Garth Brooks won, but it was one of those things that was completely intramural. It was totally within the music industry. I didn't hear my friends, no one talking about, ooh, who's going to sell more, Jewel or Garth Brooks? and the Jewel record, by the way, Spirit, I would like to go out of my way to say I think is one of the worst records of the year. I think it's just a completely empty follow-up to a perfectly nice debut album. I don't think the Garth Brooks double live album is any great shakes either. I think a lot of those big releases were very empty and bloated and padded out.
I had the pleasure of seeing some of that Garth Brooks special promoting the new record. It was an infomercial. I was just really shocked.
Yeah. I mean, this guy does everything. It's as if he's totally turned away from the idea of making music to selling music. The NBC special, the arrangements he's made with Walmarts throughout the country to release so many. He had a million copies just in Walmarts, and his goal was to sell that many in one day, the opening day of his release of that record. He's a guy who's kind of turned his back on his own talent to become this megalomaniacal, I'm going to sell more records than the Beatles, than Elvis kind of quest.
Anything that's sold really well this year that you also really liked?
Certainly Lauryn Hill's album called The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, I think, was a really terrific record in the sense that it combined hip-hop and old-fashioned R&B and old-fashioned soul music in a way that hasn't been done before. And I think it's a really striking record. I think it's going to appear on the top of most critics' lists, in fact.
Well, since it's on your list of the 10 best, why don't you play something from it for us?
Yeah, the cut I really like is a kind of hearkening back to the Stevie Wonder period of like Inner Visions period called Everything is Everything.
Let's hear it.
There was so much good work, I thought, by women in general this year. I could easily have come up with a top 10 that consisted entirely of female artists. I really liked Joni Mitchell's album, Sheryl Crow's album, which I did put on my 10 best list. There were strong releases from PJ Harvey and Lucinda Williams. And even I thought Alanis Morissette's sophomore record was, you know, kind of overloaded and overly ambitious, but I admired the fact that she was taking a lot of chances musically and rhythmically in that collection. In some ways, though, I thought the most underrated female singer-songwriter CD of the year was from Liz Phair, who put out this album called White Chocolate Space Egg. It was toward the beginning of the year, and it got a certain amount of press, but it was the wrong kind of press for this release because it was touted as her mature release. She'd grown up. She was married now. She had a kid, and she was writing about more mature things. And if there was anything that was going to turn off the young female audience who had liked her before, it was exactly that kind of positioning. But still, I thought it was very strong.
What would you like to play from it?
It's a cut called Uncle Alvarez.
There's a portrait of Uncle Alvarez hanging in the hall. Nobody wants to look at it, but Uncle Alvarez sees us all.
Liz Phair, one of the CDs on Ken Tucker's top 10 list of the year. Now that women are selling really well in the record industry, mm-hmm. and you know, I think there's always been this preconception that, you know, males buy records and females don't.
Yes,
and I think that's being disproved. So is it changing the way recordings are, like who's getting contracts and how they're getting marketed now?
I think so. I mean, I think that women and those women artists largely did it by themselves. I think you can't underestimate the importance of something like the Lilith Fair with Sarah McLachlan organizing that tour that really proved it used to be just a commonplace that you had to have a male headliner and women going out and performing as a whole tour themselves. Really showed the industry that this could sell and could sell records. Certainly, Jewel herself has sold millions and millions of records this year and proved that she was just as much of a contender as any other male artist.
Well, why don't we take a break here and then we'll talk more. My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic, Ken Tucker, and he's put together his 10 best list of the year. We'll hear more recordings from that list after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air's pop critic Ken Tucker, and we're talking about music of 1998 and listening to recordings from his 10 best list of the year. What do you have on your list that's particularly idiosyncratic?
Well, I never would have expected to put Pulp, this English band led by the singer and songwriter Jarvis Cocker, on my list. Pulp put out an album called This Is Hardcore, which was not particularly hardcore. It's a real throwback to a kind of glam rock of the 70s. And Jarvis Cocker is one of these kinds of fey English guys who normally I can't stand, very much in the tradition of the Smiths and Morrissey. But I thought that I found this record very moving. I found this record to be one English act that I like a great deal in this genre is Roxy Music, and particularly Brian Ferry. And to me, the kind of crooning that Jarvis Cocker was trying to do with his croaky little voice, I felt was very kind of poignant. And in particular, a song that I'd like to play called Help the Aged is a really very touching song about a very rarely touched upon subject, which is old people in rock and roll.
You mean old rock and rollers or elderly people sung about in rock and roll?
Elderly people being sung about with a certain amount of sympathy and respect.
Good, let's hear it.
Help the aged. One time they were just like you. Drinking, smoking, sex, and sniffing glue. Help the aged.
That's Pulp. Their CD is on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list of the year. Ken, you mentioned that they reminded you of some of the glam rock of the 70s. Did you see the glam rock movie this year, Velvet Goldmine?
Yes, I did. I was awfully disappointed. I really like director Todd Haynes' movies a lot, and this disappointed me a great deal. I found it kind of incoherent and depressing and sludgy in a way that was completely inimical to the spirit of glam rock. I thought, you know, when you think back on Bowie and the Ziggy Stardust period and Lou Reed and Rock and Roll Animal period and Iggy Pop, there's a kind of surrogate Iggy Pop character in the movie. That music was much more... it was fun, but it was also very thoughtful. This movie just kind of slowed things down. My colleague at Entertainment Weekly, Owen Gleiberman, when he reviewed the movie, praised it for what he called its, quote, narcotic poetry. And I just found it narcotic. It just put me to sleep practically, and which is exactly the opposite of what good glam rock did.
Ken, what happened in hip-hop this year?
Well, to me, hip-hop, as I listened to it, I realized that the kind of axis of the music flipped 180 degrees, whereas a year ago, all the talk was of East Coast versus West Coast. Suddenly, everything turned to North versus South, not necessarily even versus, but two different schools emerged over the course of the year. In the North, you had a group like the Wu-Tang Clan releasing these very harsh, quickly phrased staccato records. And in the South, you had someone like Master P and the group that I put on my 10 Best list, Outkast, who were really much more willing to dig deeper into Southern soul music and use it for their own purposes in rap music, kind of to a certain extent slowing down the tempo, adding a lot more kind of soul rhythm to the music without detracting from the kind of basic authentic hardness of the music. And I thought Outkast's album, which is called Aqua Mini, is really a terrific record.
What do you want to play from it?
It's a cut called Rosa Parks, named indeed after the 60s civil rights figure.
The type of people made the club before. Many a day has passed, the night has gone by, but still I find the time to put that bomb off in your eye. Total chaos,
for these playoffs. Thought we was amps and we're taking another route to represent the Dungeon family like Ray Day. Me and my nigga decide to take the back way. We stabbing every city, then we headed through that back cave. ATL, Georgia, what do we do? Fall ya. Bulldogging hoes like them Georgetown Hawkins. Boy, you signed the silly thing. My room is sitting pretty, doing donuts. Why you suckers like them suckers on Ron Titus? Damn, we the committee, gon' burn it down. But us gon' bust you in the mouth with the chorus now. Say, ah.
That's Outkast, and their CD is on Ken Tucker's 10 Best. That was pretty catchy. Kind of lost me when they started rapping. I think I'm just like so bored with rap at this point.
Really? Well, I think that there's all different kinds. I mean, I think that, it's expanded dramatically over the course of the past couple of years. I mean, I find that kind of conversational rapping that's done by Outkast and Master P and a lot of the people who work with him to be much more conversational. It's not so much about the rhyme as about the ideas behind it, mm-hmm. Which I find good. I mean, I think a lot of rap had descended into kind of facile rhyming that that now has been replaced by a kind of stream of consciousness talking that I find much more amenable to sort of conversation and thought.
My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. He'll play more music from his 1998 10 Best list after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. We're talking about his picks for the best records of 1998. Country music. You've been listening to a lot of country music for years now.
Yeah.
Was it a good year?
It was a terrible year. I mean, you know, spearheaded by Garth Brooks doing media.
He's just like us, Ken.
Yeah, I guess.
He's a man of the people.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't fly around in my house the way he flies over the stage every night. The big breakthrough act this year was this group called the Dixie Chicks, which is this terribly coy trio of young blonde women, you know, just positioned as these sex symbols. I actually went to a big country music concert this year by Shania Twain because I was very curious to see. She had put out a couple of albums and had never toured. And it was kind of fun, but, you know, it was like my 9-year-old was much more involved in it than I was. It was a kind of fun pop music concert, but that was the problem. It felt so much like pop music as opposed to country music. There just wasn't much good country music on the radio. In fact, it was only by, you know, systematically going through almost every country music album that I was sent that I managed to find the one that I felt was the best release of the year. It's a record by a woman called Dani Lee, and she's never played on radio. The record was a complete flop as far as I can tell. It's her debut album. It's called 29 Nights, and yet I think it's the strongest release of the year.
What track are we going to hear?
It's a song written by the veteran country songwriter Harlan Howard, and it's a song called I Feel a Heartache Coming On.
That's Dani Lee, and her CD is on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list of the year. And in fact, he called that the best country record of the year. Ken, are there other newcomers this year who you're particularly interested in?
Well, I really thought Rufus Wainwright's debut album was very strong. It wasn't a commercial success, but I think he's got a real future. I mean, I think that he combines aspects of his parents, Kate McGarrigle and Loudon Wainwright, with his own style. I mean, he's said that he's in love with opera, and there's this kind of theatrical operatic quality to his work. I think the guy's making his biggest breakthrough right now. He's got a Gap commercial, which is exposing him to more millions of people every time they see that commercial than have purchased his album, which is probably selling in the, low five figures.
Speaking of commercials, the big Gap commercial this year was that swing dance.
Yeah,
I mean, commercial, and now every commercial has to have swing dancers in it, no matter what they're advertising.
And to me, it was a better use of swing music than the acts that are actually selling records on this. I mean, I really detest the Squirrel Nut Zippers, who are kind of the best selling proponents of modern swing. Any of that kind of harking back. I mean, I never liked Manhattan Transfer or groups like that that tried to revive old styles in this kind of coy, winking, campy way. But those Gap commercials are just terrific because they play the music straight. They show people dancing to it in this incredibly enthusiastic, passionate, straightforward way, very unironically, unlike an act like the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
One of the things I've noticed this year, actually this started late last year, was that disco is sounding better to me now than it ever did in the 70s. And I think that's in part because of movies like Boogie Nights and Last Days of Disco.
Uh-huh.
And also because of a Teddy Pendergrass interview. I listened back to that Philadelphia International box set.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that ever happens to you, that something sounds better 20 years after it was recorded than it did in its own time.
Sometimes it does. There's a kind of, for me, it's a post-punk. Things like Nick Cave and the Seeds and Depeche Mode and bands like that that initially I didn't like, I found too cold, Bauhaus, things like that, they sound much better. I was always, I must give myself credit, really liked disco. But yes, I mean, to me, the heart-stopping moment in Boogie Nights is when you hear Casey and the Sunshine Band. It's just a wonderful moment, and you realize how good some of those records were. Gloria Gaynor's records sound really good. There was very good, solid music there that was kind of caught up at the time in this kind of, you know, contempt for the relentless beat that the mediocre records had.
Well, I think this would be a good time to read your whole top 10 list. Is this in any order?
Yes, it's in order of preference. Billy Bragg and Wilco, Mermaid Avenue. Lauryn Hill, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Lucinda Williams' record, her first in 6 years, called Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars, Dope Dogs. It's hard to find, but seek it out. My sources tell me that this brand new release is actually 4 years old and sounds absolutely up to the minute. It's a terrific piece of work. Outkast, Aquamini. On that album, George Clinton also makes a cameo appearance. It just goes to show that these whippersnappers respect their elders and pick right. Sheryl Crow's album, The Globe Sessions. Danny Lee's 29 Nights, that country album I just played. Peter Wolf making, to me, the surprise comeback of the year as far as my ears were concerned, with an album called Fool's Parade. Pulp, This Is Hardcore. And Liz Phair's White Chocolate Space Egg.
Some wonderful performers died in 1998, and it would be nice to go out with a remembrance of them. Who would you like to make note of?
Certainly Tammy Wynette, a real pioneer of strong country music made by women. Sonny Bono, you know, I don't think he got his full due in a lot of his obituaries. I really liked the fact that Sonny Bono was a real, very talented music hustler working for Phil Spector in the early days. Did a lot of good production work by himself, and it didn't get his props as a musician, I thought. But to me, the most poignant death of the year was Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys. He died February 6th. He was 51. Carl was like this, often wore a beard and was a big burly guy and seemed very gentle. And he was always kind of the peacemaker of the Beach Boys. And with all the talk of, you know, well-deserved of Brian Wilson's genius behind that group, I think his brother Carl was kind of the soul of the group in a lot of ways. And a lot of people don't even realize that he sang the lead vocals on Good Vibrations and God Only Knows, one of the most beautiful Beach Boys songs of all.
Well, before we hear God Only Knows, Ken, I want to thank you for bringing your top 10 with us, and I wish you a good Christmas and a very happy new year, and thanks for being with us.
Same to you, Terry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.